I write a column every day at HartmanReport.com, and all my books and everything are over at TomHartman.com or any bookstore. I mean, you know, I'll be doing a book signing at Powell's too next month. I don't have the date right in front of me, but you can check with Powell's and see.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
It's always so great talking with you. I really appreciate Althea when you invite me on the program. And please give my greetings to everybody there at KBOO. It's a great station.
Will do, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Althea.
That was New York Times bestselling author and progressive talk radio host Tom Hartman speaking with me about his new book. It's called The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, and How to Rescue Our Future. He'll be signing books in Portland at Powell's on October 15th at 7 p.m.
KBOO Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life, of your journey. Join us first and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon. Here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey. Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBOO 90.7 FM. Share with us your memories, experience, and journey of your life. First and third Friday of the month, from 11 to noon, here at KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Cory Doctorow, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Today, we are very honored to have with us Suzanne Ford. Suzanne is the executive director of the San Francisco Pride Festival. Suzanne, welcome to Transpositive.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you. So why don't we all go around the room and introduce ourselves, and then we'll get started with the interview. My name is Emma. I use she and her pronouns.
I'm Sheila. I use she and her pronouns.
Okay. Hi, I'm Suzanne. My pronouns are she, her.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, Suzanne, it's really an honor to have you here on Transpositive today. Transpositive is a show that's based here in Portland, Oregon. We focus on transgender and non-binary issues, and we try to really raise up the voices of transgender and non-binary folks. We're a radio show on KBOO Community Radio, which is a Pacifica affiliate. And we're just really happy to have you on Transpositive. So thanks so much for taking time this morning to join us. Suzanne, I was hoping we could start with maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and about your work with San Francisco Pride.
So, I was born and I was raised in Owensboro, Kentucky, back in the 70s. Obviously, a very conservative area. I knew from a young age that I really inside identified differently, but it was a secret I planned on never sharing. I am married to a woman. I came out about 13 years ago, first to her and then to the world. We have a son that's now at Cal Poly that we're really proud of. But once I came out, I wanted to get involved in the community. I served on some committees for TDOV and TDOR. And then I served on some boards, and I wound up serving on San Francisco Pride's board as the treasurer and also as the president at the SPAR Center board in Marin County, which is an LGBTQ service provider in Marin County. Right when we came out of the pandemic, our executive director resigned, and we had about 4 months to go before the event, and I stepped into the role, and I just completed my third Pride cycle as executive director.
Well, congratulations on that. That's just incredible, and that's such an amazing story. Suzanne, before we get into talking about Pride, because we really want to like just chat with you about Pride, because it's just such a great event. I'd love to hear more about your coming out story. Is there a chance you could tell us a little bit more about, you know, your path toward becoming the woman that you are today?
Yes, I never really thought that it was possible or that I would ever share that secret with anyone. I've been married over 10 years, and some things happened in our marriage, and explaining that to my wife, she asked a series of questions, and when I answered, she said, "So do you want to be a woman?" Now, I should have said I am a woman, but I wasn't there yet. I didn't have the courage to say that, but I said sometimes. And just that little bit of light, once it was out, it could not be contained. I started presenting as female socially, and then got everything together, and I came out publicly and at my workplace about a year later.
How are you received by your coworkers?
You know, it's so, you know, my company was in Sacramento. I live in the Bay Area, but the company was in Sacramento, and it was very male dominated, very misogynistic. And I had been one of them. The boardroom would be all men, and, you know, they were startled because I just was buried that secret so far that no one knew. And they struggled at first. I was lucky. Teresa Sparks, who was a leading trans activist in San Francisco for many years, helped me through the process. And I wouldn't say that they were happy about it, but they did. I did go away. I had a top and bottom surgery at one time. At the same time, and when I came back, they put me on a performance improvement plan. I was in sales, and they thought that my customers might just desert me. And that's the farthest thing from the truth. My customers had a front row seat, and they saw what I was going through, and I had more business. They sent more business my way. So they were afraid, I guess, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like they didn't have any reason to be afraid, obviously. Well, that's great. Yeah. So you transitioned at work, you came out, you transitioned at home. how did the transition go with your wife?
Oh, that was a journey. She was not happy. She loved her husband as he had presented himself. But, you know, she's my person and I am her person. And we, although it was difficult, it might have been easier for both of us to go our separate ways. We just didn't. We hung in there. I kept saying, you know, maybe it could be better. It's not going to be the same. I think that's the first thing to recognize when you're doing that with a spouse. It's not going to be the same. There's no reason to try to say that it's going to be the same. It will not. And I think in a lot of aspects in our life, it is better. We live a little more independently. I own a home in Southern Washington, about an hour from PDX in Silver Lake, Washington. And she spends most of her time there. I have an apartment in San Francisco, and my life is here as far as work. And we go back and forth, and we make it work. I just didn't trust anybody would love me if they knew who I really was. And that's on me. But it has been an adjustment for her. She's really not. It's been a little awkward for her to adjust to our community. It's not natural for her. And, you know, she lived in a heteronormative world for all those years, identified as straight. And I'm proud of her. She's done a really great job of seeing, you know, she's learned a lot, but it has been really difficult. But I see a lot of trans women that have wives and go through the process. And I think a lot of us end up pretty lonely. Somebody we loved had to be ripped apart for us to be ourselves as far as late transitioners go. And I hate that for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How old were you when you transitioned, Susan?
Let's see, I'm 59 now. So 46 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm one of those dinosaurs. There won't be many of us in a generation or two. So I think it's why it's important for us to do as much as we can about it. Is an interesting perspective to live presenting male in this society and then to present female, to come out and say who you are. But you can contrast all the experiences you have and the socialization you have with what's going on currently. And I think that knowledge is invaluable, but I am looking forward to the day that people transition, everyone transitions when they're young and they have the courage to say who they are and they have the support to be who they are.
Well, since you brought that up, Suzanne, I would love to take a break in the format and move into discussing this issue, because this is really the issue that is affecting trans folks right now. It's over 25 states in this country have either enacted legislation or introduced legislation really specifically targeting trans kids. As the director of the San Francisco Pride Festival, you probably are experiencing the same thing that we're experiencing here in Portland. We're getting a lot of people fleeing the South, the Midwest, and some of the rural and more remote parts of the country right now because they literally feel sometimes like their lives are in danger. Can you talk about what's going on right now in this country with trans kids and the push by the far right, and what can we do to push back?
Yes, my home state, Kentucky, is one of those 25 states that's enacted some kind of legislation limiting care for trans children. You know, at San Francisco Pride, we realized that there are a lot of people coming to San Francisco to escape oppression. I ran into it right before Pride. I spoke at an event and we went to a cafe afterwards. And there was a young trans kid. We had to kind of get between them and their table. And I noticed they gave me kind of a look. And we had breakfast and then we talked to them. And I gave them my card. And I said, you know, if you'd like to go to the VIP party at City Hall, we'd love to have you. And I gave them my card. And then the next day I received an email from the mother. There were three teenagers and a mother. And she said, I just want to let you know, we just moved here from Texas so that my trans son could receive treatment, gender-affirming care. And so a lot of times we we know about it, but that like really brought it home for me. Like, yeah, it's really important. And I try to talk that about that a lot. We have to get ready because they are going to come here. You know, San Francisco has a lot of healthcare, like some of the best surgeons in the world. And we are a sanctuary city now for transgender people, but we're not ready for what's really coming, I don't think. We don't really have the resources lined up to take care of all the people that are coming. My heart aches. It just aches that they would treat children like this. You know, as you know, there's a lot of miseducation. This thing about young children having surgery is bogus. It's not true. But, you know, it's very nuanced. Our answer to those people is very nuanced, and their claim is very simple. You know, young people are being mutilated. We have to say, no, they're not. We are providing blockers to postpone puberty while they go through the process to make sure of who they are. Like, it's just a more, we have to take more time to educate people than what they do. And I think that puts us at a disadvantage. I think you've seen some attempts to humanize those children, the brave children that do allow that. But that's a lot to ask of a, you know, teenager or even younger than teen to come out as the face of that. That's a very difficult ask.
It seems like what you just described is, it seems like that's been the strategy of the right wing. You know, they began this attack on children in North Dakota. And they created legislation in North Dakota that was then picked up by several state legislatures around the country. And I think that what you said really goes to the heart of it. It's that they're basically targeting people who, it's really hard for them to speak for themselves. It takes an incredible amount of courage when you're a teenager or younger to not only just come out and deal with all of the processes that are involved in coming out as trans or non-binary, but then to also have to be the face of a movement of resistance. And somehow it seems like we need to figure out how to support those kids so that they're not being, that they're so much more likely right now to be victims of, self-harm because they're so intensely in the public spotlight. One of the things that I think really benefits our movement so much is if we can really speak positively about what it means to be able to transition when you're young. I mean, because part of what they're doing is they're telling us that, you know, that it's not real. They're using the same things they've been using against us for 40 years. And Sheila, maybe this is a good place for you to step in and ask a question or make a comment, because you've been dealing with this your whole life, Sheila. What are the same old tropes they've been using against us for the last 40 years that they're using right now on trans kids?
Well, thank you. One of the things that's the newest is the sheer scope of the exposure. I came up during what I'd call the invisible years. That even precedes the 70s. And what we noticed is that in the early days, this was a purely clinical phenomenon and was seen as such a micro issue that the idea that it would ever come up in a political election, let alone be a center point of the rhetoric, would have been absolutely beyond our belief. The very first exposure to the nation as a whole came through the talk shows from Sally Jesse Raphael to Phil Donahue. And then there was actually an episode of All in the Family that had a drag queen on there. And that was seen as being remarkably progressive at the time to have that issue aired on All in the Family. And then other than that, everything was just kind of an idea that a kind of a throwback clear into the 50s. The very first operations done in Denmark. And then for a while there was a period where people like Canary Khan came out, and the places you went then were either down to Tijuana, or you went to Morocco, of all things. And now look where we are now. And what we're having now is this idea that there's no such thing as a clinical entity of being transgender. This is a purely social phenomenon. It's a Western liberal invasive into the colonies of Africa sign of general Western decadence, which is the narrative that's coming out from Putin and in Russia and in Belarus and in Eastern Europe. So it's also being seen as a geographical struggle with certain liberal countries versus other countries. And the other countries are very, very much trying to build their own narrative of America first. But it, for them, is we're going to make Russia great again. We're going to do it by eliminating Western influences, and we're going to go back to holy Russia, complete reversal from Stalin's ideas, which is a socialist a thing. Russia actually represents a hyper-capitalist thing. Now, when the gay movement began, there were two sectors. There was the Gay Liberation Front, and there was, I think, the Gay Activist Alliance. And then San Francisco came in with the idea of the Castro, and everybody, the Mecca in those days was for everyone gay to go to the Castro, which blew out of the 1967 Summer of Love. So now that our guest is here today, my first question is San Francisco still the Mecca of gay life, and particularly transgender life? Because I'm hearing that Seattle and Portland are actually becoming where people are fleeing to even more than San Francisco.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I live in the Castro. You know, I think you might see some people coming to Portland and Seattle because the Bay Area is so expensive. I'm sure there's some of that, but I don't know enough about your city government in Seattle and Portland, but I can tell you, you know, I spoke about my mentor, Teresa Sparks. She was the first transgender advisor to the mayor of San Francisco, and she was part of the formation of the Office of Transgender Initiatives. And I don't know if you all have that kind of office, but Mayor Lee was the first mayor in the United States to put over $1 million specifically for transgender issues into the budget of San Francisco. Mayor Breed has certainly been a partner with the transgender district. We have districts, historical districts in San Francisco, and the transgender district in the Tenderloin is centered around where the Compton's Cafeteria riot play occurred. So I will say that I feel like in city government we're represented. Honey Mahogany ran for supervisor, but now she's been appointed to Office of Transgender Initiatives. You know, you're talking about a Black trans woman, smart, fierce. So I don't want to say, I know there are different cultures in Portland and in Seattle, and I don't want to denigrate those, but I know that when something happens in our country, they call my office for a comment. They call my office for a reaction. I would say that we are in the fabric of the city now. We're not just a group over here that they're trying to throw a few crumbs. I have a strong relationship with the mayor's office and the supervisors. And so I still think if you looked at our power structure in San Francisco, I think that you would say that especially gay white men, are very powerful in San Francisco now compared to the 60s or 70s. And I think you are seeing transgender people. Unfortunately, I think it's centered too much on trans women disproportionately. I think we have a larger voice a lot of times than trans mass people. But I do feel like we are part of talking about issues that face us, and we are part of designing the solutions now here in San Francisco. And I think we're headed in the right direction. I met the new executive director in Seattle of Pride, and Portland. I love Portland, and I know Portland. I think Portland for young queer people might be more of a capital than San Francisco when it comes to young queer people. But I think all three cities are espousing a lot of the same ideologies. You might have some different solutions, or you might be known for one thing over another, but all three of us know that our communities face problems, and we are all three, I think, active in trying to solve them.
Very much so. Go ahead, Sheila.
I have my next question that I had was to follow up on this whole thing about how do we frame ourselves? And I can start by how we're being framed. From those early days where we were struggling for visibility, it's a paradox that now, in some ways, what I think all of us would like is a certain amount of invisibility. We'd like to simply live our lives. And particularly for people that transition in mid to later life, it's hard to picture people being threatened by a lot of transgender old ladies. So this is really about the struggle for how we define youth and how we define early adulthood. And so the narrative that's being put out against us is that this is an exportation of a mass delusion that is causing everyday non-transgender people to question their gender. And there's naturally, when you're first moving psychologically from where in elementary school, all of your friends and all of your close associations and even your early crushes may be same-sex oriented, puberty kind of brings on heterosexuality. And that's when all of a sudden you start noticing the other sex that was formerly the icky sex with cooties from my era. And suddenly they're wonderful and they're everything. And those that don't make that transition to heterosexual normativity are the people that we would refer to as gay or transgender. And so the question is, how can they feel that we are not the invaders when all we're asking for is to let the people that are in that second group that are having trouble not feel pressured out, marginalized, or beat up at school, right, and therefore don't have to carry all that garbage with them for the rest of their lives or go into silent running mode, which causes so many trans folks, I'm sure yourself and me, to feel like we can't share who we are, and therefore we can't even really develop who we are. So we set up a public persona that meets what we're expected to do, and then it takes a whole lifetime to get our way out of that persona. And meanwhile, we've been damaged psychologically in ways that hurt us in other areas, and that's where you see increase in suicides, you see increase in look at what drugs do now. Drugs used to be just a temporary way station. Now it's with fentanyl, it's a highway to death. So what do you do to save trans youth and gay youth from literally being sacrificed to an agenda that's abusing them? And that's why, whereas we see ourselves as rescuers of trans youth, they see us as indoctrinators and seducers. And that's the problem.
Yeah, I agree. It is the problem. And I agree with you, before it was visibility. I think we have different roles according to where we are in life. I I think of my role as a late transitioner and somebody that's in the public eye a lot and has a certain amount of notoriety in San Francisco. And I feel like because I hid those years, I owe back to the Black trans women that couldn't hide, that didn't hide, that were fierce. And I feel like my job is to humanize us. I mean, I'm visible, that's for sure, in San Francisco. But I want both cis people to see that we are powerful people. We obviously have different philosophies about a lot of things, but we're still powerful people. We have families. We want to take care of those families. We want to take care of our friends. And we share those values with many people. So I think my job is, I'm a trans ambassador now. Like when I talk to groups and I do a Q&A, I will say, listen, for the next 20 minutes, you can ask me anything you want. You won't say anything wrong. I might educate you. I might say, hey, you might want to use this word. But I want to tell you, you should never assume that you could ask trans people these questions, but my job is to answer them. So that's the way I see my role. As I agree with you, we're seeing now as corrupting the children. So I think that's why we have to do a better job as late transitioners, to talk about the anguish. Talk to our friends, say, you know, when you thought I was okay, I wasn't. Well, like in my instance, I was an athlete, and in Kentucky, I was a basketball player. In Kentucky, your whole social thing, if you're a basketball player, you are like, you have it made socially. And they thought I was one of them. I was in that locker room scared to death. They'd really know who I was. There was a boy in the seventh grade that, you know, we hooked up on the power forward on the basketball team. And no one knew that about me. It was such a dissonance from the image. And that is damaging, like you say. And so now I need to tell that story. I need to be vulnerable, tell that story so that they know that we're trying to save these children from anguish, from walking around thinking, if you really knew who I was, you wouldn't love me. And that is so damaging. So I agree with you. That's how we're seeing. And I think finally, I'm sorry it's a long answer, but I speak to a lot of groups that agree with us or that at least are open to us. I'm looking forward to my career. I hope that I'll be speaking in groups that don't agree with us, that I'll be in front of people in the Midwest and the Southeast, and that we'll be able to humanize it. Like, so I don't know, I hope that answers your question. It's a great question, and it's obviously it's got many layers, and I think I want to make sure, I think this is my role, but it's not everybody's role. I think that's a misnomer too. We start thinking that all trans people have to do the same thing in order to help our cause. And, you know, my position requires some moderate politics that I don't think our group as a whole should probably adopt. I have to work with the city, some law enforcement agencies. I'm in charge of something that has to keep going. And sometimes we make compromises where other people wouldn't, and I'm glad they don't. I'm glad there are young queer people saying the system is flawed, but my job is to keep something going in a system that's flawed. So, you know, I think that's important too. Like, you know, Susan Stryker, a leading historian for trans people, she has a different voice than mine, and I really respect what she does and why she does it.
I have another question.
Okay.
Years ago, there was a real effort at the federal level to break up the LGBT quad, these four, and they basically the thought was these are actually separate entities. And so the idea of a pride parade, including everybody, is really kind of a misnomer. And then there's elements within our own extended community that feels the same way. Now, AIDS actually acted as a great unifier. I'm still so proud of the lesbian people that joined Chicken Soup Brigade and other things like that and helped out their gay brothers at a time when there just wasn't enough hands to go around. And what I'm wondering is that there are different issues, and of course the gay community is extremely broad, all the way from leather to drag queens. And I think there's always been an overlap for us with the drag community, because when the series Pose brought out the idea that, especially during the 80s and the 90s, if you were a young trans person, that was actually probably your safest place to go for a community. If you went to a trans group, you were there with the middle-aged transitioners and people who usually had pretty good jobs, whereas you had nothing, and yet you were pretty and you were young and you had your whole life in front of you. And so that division, that generation division, still exists within our specific trans community, but then we also have to interface with all the rest of it. And as the head of the Pride Parade, you're seeing all these different voices, and it's very important, I think, that we stay together, because with one of us falls, it's just like whittling us down to a stick, to a toothpick, and there won't be anything left. We need all the friends we can get. So what do you think about some of these thoughts today?
I think my friend Imani Rupert Gordon, that's the executive director of NCLR, does a great, great job in explaining to her constituents why it's so important for NCLR to provide legal help in the cases, especially anti-trans legislation against children. And when she talks about that, she does a great job of saying, listen, they're coming for them today, but it will be you tomorrow. We're all in this together. And I love to hear her speak about that. And I love the work that the NCLR does for trans people. It's just they really spend a lot of their resources on trans people. I always want to acknowledge the differences. I don't think it does any good to act like there are not differences. Just like I think as a late transitioner, when I speak to a group of cis women, I do acknowledge that I was socialized differently, that it has some different outcomes. It shouldn't separate us, but we should acknowledge the difference. So, you know, San Francisco Pride has been intentional. I think I'm sitting in that chair because of that intention to make sure that trans people are represented, and not just represented, but have a strong voice, because we've always been there. We've always been strong voices, especially Black and Brown trans people. But I know that it is pulling us apart at different times. For example, you know, the Palestinian supporters were angry with us that we didn't go far enough. We did release a statement calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, but they did not want me to take some corporate money that we did, and they overall used the platform of Pride to protest, and they boycotted. There were some young queer people that didn't come out this year. And I, you know, I want to take that personally, because those are my people. But I think it's really important in our community that we can have principled disagreements. And I understand my personal politics lie more that way. But my job is to keep San Francisco Pride together so that that platform can be used for the right things. And, you know, what they did is fine. They had a protest on Pride Sunday. There were 2,000 people there up on Church and Market. They did not disrupt the parade, and I'm so grateful that they didn't. But they needed, you know, they used the Pride platform, and I think that's really important. So I think you're right. We need to stick together. We all know the history of HRC. We know about Barney Frank and being sold down the road to moderate Republicans and how that worked out. Anytime they do that, we all lose, and especially trans people. We're the ones usually that pay the bill. So sometimes I think as trans people, we've been hurt so much that we stay in that hurt instead of making sure that our coalitions with different people are strong. And I will say in my case, two of my closest mentors, advisors, are Marcy Edelman and Janie Spar, who are legend, you know, they're lesbians, cisgendered lesbians that have, in the 70s, they started all this, and I owe them everything. But, you know, we have differences. They this year, Marcy was upset with me over there was a perceived slight at the women's stage, and you know, I'm close enough to her that she said she was upset with me, and I'm really close to her, and it hurt. But you know what? That means that I'm doing the work and she's doing the work. I have a close enough relationship that a lesbian can say to me, a trans woman, you missed the mark. You didn't think about us. You didn't appreciate that we were marginalized in this process, and you fed into that. And it's okay for me to say, you know, I didn't think of that. That didn't occur to me. That's not the way I was looking at it, but you're right. So all that to say, yes, we do have differences, but we ought to be able to disagree and still come together. And that, I think that San Francisco Pride, that's my job, to bring as many people together as possible and let all of them have their principled arguments and thoughts and causes.
I got two other questions. This is a great opportunity for me. Can I just ask a really fast quick? Yes.
Okay, I want to do an ID really quick. And then I also want to ask a question about kind of going in the theme of where Suzanne was going right now, talking about Pride. So would it be all right if I went ahead and did that? And then
you can. Maybe you can even ask my question, because it's a real quickie. Ask, there's two prongs. One is the Castro now seen as sort of like a yesterday Mecca, kind of like the Stonewall Inn? That's question one. And the second, or is it still an active and vital and a new transition, a different Castro than the old Castro?
Those are great questions. Why don't you save them and ask them in just a minute, okay?
Okay, sure.
Okay, great. So you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. We're talking today with Suzanne Ford. Suzanne is the executive director of San Francisco Pride, and she's a transgender woman. And so we're having a chance to chat right now about issues related to trans women, to coming out, Pride, working together across coalitions, a whole bunch of stuff. But Suzanne, we were just talking about kind of the origins of Pride, you know, back in the 70s when it got started, and having these coalitions going. One of the questions I have for you that we always ask Deborah Porta, who's the executive director here of Pride Northwest, is what do you think is the future of Pride? I mean, Pride started as a movement to gain recognition, to assert our rights. We've come a long way in our rights. We have a lot of people now in elected office. We have Pride festivals all around the country. You know, we've gotten huge support from very, very many sectors of the community. And a lot of it was because of these movements that Pride represents. So now that we've achieved all of this, what is the future of Pride now? Is Pride still necessary?
Well, I first of all, I don't think we have achieved all of it. I think we made some gains, and then some of them have been called back. So I think we're more important than ever, to tell you the truth. I think it is true that we have outgrown that first iteration. We are no longer just a protest. I mean, for us, we are trying to celebrate our culture, commemorate our heritage, educate the world, and liberate our people. That's our mission statement. So for some people, Pride Sunday is about a party. It's about joy. It's about being with each other in joy. To some people, like I said, just not showing up at Pride is a protest. And there are people, you know, there were groups that supported different causes in the parade. And I think in our case, like I can't go backwards. I, you know, we run a, it's a little like a $4.5 million organization. Just the insurance for the 2 days, security and medical services is $1.4 million. So, you know, the festival itself covers 12 blocks near the Civic Center in San Francisco. The costs are enormous now, just the labor alone. And then I think people are missing this piece. And first of all, San Francisco Pride is still totally free. So that drives us more. We were totally dependent on corporate funding and the proceeds from the event. Luckily, in the last 2 years, we've been able to go to the city and say, hey, we're more important than ever from an economic impact place, and we need your help coming out of the pandemic. And we have received some help. It's not enough, but a big increase from where we were. However, the events itself is not sustainable. I don't think young people drink as much alcohol as they once did. like I said, the costs are high. The entertainment model has totally flipped. You know, you used to tour so you could sell records. When I was growing up, you'd release a record, you go out and tour to support it. Now, people release music so that you will hire them to perform. It's completely backwards, and it's shifted. If you are a free festival and that's the model, then somebody that cost me $10,000 pre-pandemic may now cost $100,000. Mm-hmm. And I have not found the answer to that yet, to tell you the truth. And it worries me. And I think a lot of prides are facing that problem, that issue. That's why you're seeing more and more prides charge for the music events, for the street fair, the music events. I do appreciate when people want it to go back to the protest it was, and my answer to that is go have a protest, pull a permit or not, and protest. There's a thing called the People's March in San Francisco now, and they were born out of frustration with us. And you know, they haven't been able to draw that many people, but you know, they draw 500 to 800 people. We draw almost 1 million people, 50,000 people march in our parade. Like, people are voting with their feet. Like, I, you know, like sometimes we're nostalgic for things that we really don't support, I think. And I hate to say it, because really, you know, I'm probably more in line with the People's March, but that's not my job. That's a long answer, but you know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. Sheila, I think you had a couple of questions.
I do. One of the things I should bring up is that religion plays a huge role in how we're perceived, and the increased religiosity and the forms that it's taken often uses transgender people and gay people as being number one on God's hit list. And I take religion very seriously. I know Emma does also. We come from fairly conservative traditions in our own way, you know, from Judaism to Catholicism. And I wrote a book dealing with all of this because I wanted to explain the tension involved, but I've never felt too conscience ridden when I've gone against what I see as the primary evils, which are violence towards trans people. I don't think anybody can agree with that, and I don't think that making people's lives psychologically untenable is something that is necessarily a virtuous thing either. And that's why I've always opted for the clinical model of what we're doing rather than a political model. But I also have a certain nostalgia quality, and this is just a personal interest in our history. So my first, I've got two questions coming out of that little prelude. The first is the role of San Francisco as a mecca. it anchors people's awareness. One is Stonewall Inn, the other is the Black Cat in San Francisco, and the Castro and the memory of the Harvey Milk days. So I'd like you to comment on our history, and if the Castro a living entity, or is it a relic and a kind of an icon where history's moved on? And so that's question one. And question two deals with AIDS. One of the things that really put LGBT on the map was actually paradoxically the AIDS crisis. But I feel very bad that some of our young people are still contracting AIDS. And I think we should do everything possible to tell them that's no longer the badge of admission. Don't get AIDS. Don't get hepatitis. Don't ruin your body in the early part of your life that you're going to have to suffer with forever. And so what's being done to fight AIDS in San Francisco?
Great questions. First question, I believe, yes, the Castro is very much alive. Of course, the pandemic posed a lot of issues. I think there was a lot of tension between the merchants and the unhoused population and people that lived in those neighborhoods. And I think they're still working that out. I don't think they've come up with a total solution. However, I can tell you, I live in a Castro, and inevitably when I go down in the Castro within two blocks, somebody has said, "Hi, Suzanne." I recognize somebody that is in the movement somehow. They either work at nonprofits that I know about, or they work for the city, or we just are connected. And that is awesome to me coming, you'd think the small town in Owensboro, Kentucky would be connected like that, but they're not. The Castro is. Tomorrow morning, I will be in an announcement from the mayor's office where the new GLBT Historical Museum is going to be placed. That's going to be in the Castro. It's been intentional, too. More and more people are holding events in the Castro to support the merchants and to also make a statement that we are here and we're not going anywhere. It's still our place. I think what's really great is more and more trans people don't see the Castro as a place they never go. It's still true that there's a sizable portion of trans people that don't go to the Castro. And I think being a white trans woman probably makes it easier for me. I don't like that, but I think that's probably true. The second question, I went to this SF AIDS Foundation gala on Saturday night, and I can tell you 100% that all the people that are decision makers at ERGs for corporations, for the city government, for all the nonprofits, we were all there. And I know Dr. Tyler Tamir, the executive director of SFH Foundation, they have 225 employees. I can't remember what their annual budget, maybe $20 million a year. That's a guess. But there's absolutely work on the ground being done in San Francisco. And then you have the research. You have UCSF. We have the pharmaceutical companies, Gilead's in San Francisco. So do people get a lackadaisical about HIV at times and think it's just a problem of the past? Yes. But are people constantly reminded that that's not the case and that we have to dedicate resources to that? And then finally, I'll say, as somebody that lived in the heteronormative crowd during that period, I'm so honored. I go to events all the time where I run into people that were in ACT UP, that were part of that movement, or were lesbians that took care of gay men during that era. I meet those people all the time. And they definitely are honored in San Francisco. When you go to an event where somebody like that's honored, you can just feel it in the room. Everybody knows what we owe them. And I love that about San Francisco. If I was living in Portland or Seattle or any New York, I mean, I would be sick and tired of hearing about San Francisco. But that's my only experience as a trans woman is San Francisco. And I can tell you that I feel really connected to our history because I'm part of it, and it made me cry. I wouldn't trade that for anything. I love San Francisco.
Thank you. That's so wonderful. We've got just a couple of minutes left. I'd like to ask a final question, and also want to make sure Sheila has a chance to ask one final question. So Suzanne, thank you again so much for joining us on Transpositive. We've been talking today with Suzanne Ford, the executive director of the San Francisco Pride Festival and an out transgender woman. Suzanne, what's the future of the Pride movement in San Francisco and around the U.S.? What do you think the future of Pride is going to look like?
Well, that's a great question. I wish I knew. I think you're going to see all of us search for continuity. We can't afford aberrations or bad years or bad management. And not to say that everything we're doing is super, you know, put together, but I think all of us are going to go through a crucial period. If we did have a pullback in corporate sponsorship, all of us over the next year, we definitely would have to reduce our footprints. So I think it's going to be a critical time the next 3 to 5 years. I know for us in New York, this year will be the 55th. So we're trying to think about the 60th anniversary of SF Pride, which would be in 2030. But I think the jury's out. I think people are going to have to decide whether it's important to them. And I sometimes don't know. You know, some young queer people, it's not. And I think that they will be the ultimate deciders. Are they going to be a part of, are they going to be support? Are they going to financially support? Because we're going to have to go back more and more to people in our community and say, you know, you're going to have to, you know, just like the generations in the 70s, you know, even if you gave $2, you gave something. And we've kind of lost that, I think. And we've got to do a better job of telling young queer people that we have to have them. We want your voice. We want you to show up and tell us what you need from us. But you can't just show up and do that. You've actually got to put some skin in the game. And I think that will probably determine if these large prides are still around in 5 to 10 years.
Thank you. Sheila?
Yes. There's still so many questions I have.
Sheila, we only have time for one question. It's got to be brief because we're out of time.
Okay, I'll scoot it in. I guess my last question then is that I hope you're taking care of your own personal safety. I think that whatever happens with this next election is going to make, in fact, even losing the presidential election could cause a lot of local disturbances as various people look around for targets. So I hope you will be personally safe, and that maybe the community, I think it's not too early to alert the communities around to be extra vigilant in case of a loss, because they're going to be out of disappointment. Sometimes violence ensues. So any thoughts on that?
Well, I have a lot of experience with that. I have received lots of death threats. The last cycle was probably the worst. We did have a credible threat that the FBI tracked down for a recent event. So it is real. It is out there, the threat. I think whichever way the election goes, tell you the truth, if we win, there's going to be some violence on the other side in the people that, you know, we're always going to be, especially trans people, we're going to be the visible. I don't know about you, but I don't pass and I'm out in public. And so, you know, we're visible. I don't think gay men quite have that same experience that, you know, but if we lose, then they're going to be emboldened. So it's funny, when I was told about the threat recently, I said, well, that means we're doing something right. That was my first response. And the person I said that to was a cisgendered person, not in our community, but somebody that works for the place that the event was. And she was kind of horrified with my response, but I'm kind of numb to it, right? I did contact the law enforcement. I did speak with several different people. We did have security there. We took some action about it, but I'm kind of numb to it. And that's sad. That's, you know, it should be like, oh my God, we had a threat. Like, it should be like, oh no, like, I can't believe this. This shouldn't, you know, but to us now, it's been, you know, I think that's where you remember that you're San Francisco Pride. People associate the Pride movement with San Francisco Pride. And so, unfortunately, that brings some attention that might not be safe.
Well, Suzanne, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for speaking with us. You're an amazingly courageous person, and we're just so glad to have a chance to chat. Sheila, do you have any closing parting words for us?
I'd also like to, this was such a very clear and forthright conversation, and it's just, you know, we're playing with definitions. I do a lot of stuff on all the use of language and how language affects our perceptions. And I just feel like we're living in a kind of linguistic salad, and it's just causing so much harm in people's lives as everybody struggles for various definitions. And I think for us, it's not so much a definitional struggle as a struggle for survival. So those are my last thoughts.
Well, Suzanne, again, thank you again so much for joining us on TransPositive, and good luck with your work this year. And we are just really delighted to have had you on the show.
Well, I'm delighted that you asked, and it's been a most thoughtful conversation. I think more conversations like this will happen, so I'm really, really grateful that you all asked me. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.